Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. We're coming to you from Spirit Square's McGlohan Theater for a public conversation, Beyond She Says, Sexual Assault in Charlotte. And an added warning, we will be talking about sexual assault, a topic that could be sensitive for some listeners. She Says is, of course, the WFAE-produced podcast series that began in May and traces one woman's journey from the moments before her sexual assault through the labyrinth survivors must navigate in their search for justice. As the series makes strikingly clear, the road is long and winding, sometimes torturous, and justice can often be undefinable and many times unattainable. For those who may not be familiar with the journey the She Says podcast explores, here are a few moments from the series, beginning with the sexual assault survivor we're calling Linda, and including members of the justice system who WFA reporter and podcast host Sarah D'Elia spoke with in the course of the series.
He made a comment and said, "This is where I bring everyone," and laughed. And I was just very uncomfortable at this point. Very uncomfortable. And that's when he pulled the box cutter out. And then I really felt like he was going to kill me.
Lieutenant Peacock's going to talk about some preventative measures that some of our victims didn't take, could have taken, and our community members probably should take.
And I pointed from like my head to my toes, and I said, "Does this look like consent to you?" I was just shocked. You know, I thought, these people would be trained on this. The first thing you do is you believe someone when they tell you this.
I need to know that you don't feel like I purposely lied about stuff. I need to know that from you.
Why
for
do you need
my,
to know that?
For my sanity.
Yeah, I would not have said that. I would have tried to use my words again of, she was ventilating, and I would have validated it. I would have said, yes, I do believe you. And until there's something that would lead me otherwise, I'm always going to believe you. I think that's important for a victim to hear that.
She said she felt certain that it was him. And I remember my response was very quick, and I said, "I know it's him. I mean, there's just no question there, period, in the story."
If she had not done the Google research and provided that name, I mean, would we be here today? Would he be arrested today?
Probably not. It's hard to say. I mean, her providing that information was critical, but unfortunately, it does not give us probable cause to charge him just based on that.
Him being prosecuted and found guilty and put away is one element of justice. But I think ultimately she has a bigger picture than that, and it's justice that women will be heard.
This hour we'll hear from law enforcement and from a sexual abuse survivor who now leads an organization supporting people impacted by sexual abuse. But we're going to begin with the woman who has been working on telling not only Linda's story and her quest for justice following sexual assault, but painting a bigger picture of what makes every woman's story different and agonizing in its own way. Sarah D'Elia is the reporter and host behind and in front of She Says. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Mike.
Nice to have you here. Now, for those people who may not have heard any of these episodes or not all of these episodes or may not be familiar with She Says or where the idea came from, how did it come about?
So Linda contacted WFAE and specifically our news director sometime last spring, and they started a dialogue just about what our coverage was about sexual assault and what we were looking into and what we weren't looking into. And through the course of them talking, she disclosed that she was a sexual assault survivor, and she felt like she didn't have a lot of answers and that time kept ticking on from the time of her assault to the present day. And so he brought that story to the newsroom with her permission and kind of said, "This woman has a story. It sounds really interesting. Who wants to look into it?" And I remember at the point, I thought it was really important that a woman contact her, just that would be a really vulnerable relationship and it would be helpful to be another woman speaking to a woman. So then it got signed to me, and I talked to her. And I talked to her for about an hour and a half the first time on the phone, and I was just really blown away by her story and that she wasn't getting answers she felt. So she was you know, taking things into her own hands to kind of investigate her own case.
And up to this point, your familiarity with this kind of story was what? Limited?
Limited, yeah, that's fair. Yeah, I had done some reporting on criminal justice issues and police shootings and things like that. But as far as working really closely for a subject as long as I ended up working with Linda, I hadn't done that. And, you know, diving into sexual assault and sex crimes was something that was new for me, too.
This kind of story strikes me as something that could be potentially incendiary. It's also he said, she said, which mm-hmm. is hence the name of the podcast. What was your process? How did you verify and investigate Linda's story? This is a long series of podcasts, long, half-hour-long programs. That's a lot of tape, a lot of interviews, a lot of copy to write, to be checked. What was the process?
Well, there was lots of background checks. We did a background check on Linda. We pulled arrest records. We pulled court documents. We interviewed people that she knew. And we, you know, sort of tried to verify everything that she was saying. It helped that she decided that she was going to start recording her conversations with the police. So when she would say, "Can you believe that so-and-so said this?" Well, I didn't have to second guess it because I heard the recordings. So because she was doing her own detective work and we were doing our best to verify everything that she said, you know, I felt really confident in it.
And that's part of the story, the fact that Linda had to do a lot of her own detective work, at least initially. So for people who have not heard the podcast, you're profiling this one woman. It's her story. Encapsulate her story. What is that story?
So Linda was sexually assaulted over 3 years ago in Charlotte, not terribly far from where we are now. And she was sexually assaulted by a stranger. She had been drinking that night, and she went for a walk. She was also seeking drugs that night, and she found someone who introduced her to the man that she says assaulted her. She got into a car with that man, and he took her to a secluded location and assaulted her. And she was able to convince him to let her go and drop her off. And so from there, she had to remember some really important clues from that night. She says that she remembers that he had a patch, like a worker's patch on a uniform. She said that he told her how old he was and disclosed a nickname. And the company that he worked for was also on his shirt. So from that, she took to Google a couple months later because she felt like she wasn't getting any answers. And from that, she felt like she found the man that assaulted her. So she gave that information to the police and sort of had to wait a while before anything panned out. But that was the kind of detective work that she started to do from the day of her assault till now.
And it was a long and winding road, and those are your words, I think, from the very first opening moments of the first podcast. When did you begin to view this as a journey?
When I sat down, I had so much tape, and I had spoken to so many people, and I didn't know how to write the first sentence because it was overwhelming. I mean, when you right. have so many opinions and you're trying to be fair to everyone, because I don't think that it's a black and white sort of situation. I think there's a lot of gray. Where do you even start? And so I'm an English major, and I really like metaphors. And the winding road was just a metaphor that I could cling to, that after talking to a lot of survivors, they were like, yeah, it is. You think you're going one way, you're going the wrong way. You think that you have some comfort in the direction you're going, and you get there, and it's a dead end. So that was the metaphor that I clung to because I thought it would help me write and also help people understand the story.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but as far as we can tell, this is the first time this has been done, that anybody has taken this much of an in-depth look at one person's journey through the system as a result of sexual assault. Is that accurate?
I mean, we looked at a lot of other podcasts and a lot of other bodies of work that sometimes we could see similarities, but we didn't find anything quite like what we were doing.
Does that surprise you, given the frequency with which this happens, that no one else has done this before and explained the process to people out there?
I mean, I think it's one of those things that it's just really complicated and people prefer to put their head down. You know, I mean, I didn't know half of what I know now when I started because it's really complicated. And so how do you spend time investigating and looking into this system if you don't think it applies to you? And the thing that I don't think a lot of people realize is that we all know somebody that's been affected by sexual assault, whether it's you, whether it's a family member. It's maybe somebody that's just never disclosed that to you. So, you know, we were really trying to get people invested in it because this affects everybody.
The people who worked on this podcast with you are all women. I'm just
curious. Greg Collard's a man.
Well, yes. Last I checked, yes. For the three women who worked on this, what was this experience like? What was your reaction as this began to unfold and you began to see how intricate all this is and how difficult this can be? Not just Linda's story, but other stories.
Yeah, I don't know if my perspective, I mean, it's interesting because I thought being a woman would help me get closer to Linda of like, this is, you know, I could see myself putting myself in your shoes. I'm empathizing with you. But I don't know how much of me being a woman actually, you know, played a role into it. I know that I listened to every phone call that we got from sexual assault survivors, and it impacted me. I mean, I felt those calls, and I'll never forget them.
Yeah.
But I think that if a man listened to them, hopefully they would have the same reaction. And I've spoken to a lot of men that have listened to the podcast, and we have had male sexual assault survivors too call us, and we've played those calls. But they have said, you know, I didn't realize what it was like, and especially those victims that didn't feel like they could come forward for whatever reason. I mean, just hearing their reasoning, it punches you in the gut, and it affects you.
This is a long, her journey at least was very long. It's not over
right yet.
The podcast may have ended, but she's still fighting through the system with this. Is that because it's sexual assault, or is that, would that be typical of any crime? If it had been a murder, if it had been, I don't know, a larceny that involved bodily harm, would the situation be the same? Would it have taken this long?
Well, I'm sure that the law enforcement on the panel will be able to better explain that than me, but I think that sexual assault investigations are very complicated, and I think that it has a lot to do, why it takes so long is because of the crime lab. If there's DNA evidence and there's a backlog of that, detectives have really high caseloads. The detectives are backlogged.
And there's a backlog of 200 rape kits, and we'll talk about that in the next segment. There are 200 rape kits that are yet to be tested in Mecklenburg County alone. This journey began for Linda in June of 2015. It is now August of 2018. The final episode of the podcast dropped, and that chronicles her first face-to-face meeting with the perpetrator since the crime, but it's not resolved. So what is the future of this case?
Well, that's a really good question. I think Linda would like to know the answer to that, too. I mean, what comes up next for her? Her case is part of the legal system now. And she's waiting for something called a scheduling conference where there's going to be, you know, the prosecution and defense getting together and deciding what is the appropriate course from there. And I think it's really ironic. It's just a coincidence, but it's really funny that that conference was supposed to happen around the time that the podcast dropped. Then it got pushed back to around this time, and now it's pushed off until the fall. So I guess we'll see like what coincidental thing is going on in the fall.
We have 30 seconds, and we talked about this yesterday, you and I, and you didn't blame any one individual or any one thing on the time that it has taken for this to be resolved. What is it, operation here? What is the problem?
Well, I think the problem is that we have a culture that allows for people to be sexually assaulted. I think that's probably the problem. And if that stopped, you know, we would probably, everyone up on the stage would be a lot happier. Mm. I think that's an issue. And also just the amount of work on everyone's plate, it slows everything down.
Sarah D'Elia is the host and producer of She Says Podcast. We will continue our conversation in a moment. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is a special edition of Charlotte Talks, Beyond She Says, Sexual Assault in Charlotte, a public conversation from the McGlohan Theater at Spirit Square. I'm Mike Collins. After every episode of WFAE's She Says podcast, host Sarah D'Elia invited listeners who had experienced sexual assault to phone a special number and share their experiences anonymously. Here are a couple of comments we received from women talking about their experiences with law enforcement.
When I reported my sexual assault, the police officer that I reported it to surprisingly treated me with such compassion. Unfortunately, the detective was the total opposite. He basically made it seem like, not that he didn't believe me, but that it was an ultimate waste of his time.
I was not proud of where I was, put myself in a bad situation, but I was young, and I felt like I didn't deserve what happened to me. But one of the worst parts was the police treated me basically like I didn't matter because I did put myself in a bad position, and that was one of the worst traumas of all.
They transferred me to 911, and the officer said, "You're telling me you were raped by your husband, and it was a week ago? Why are you crying?"
One of the questions that I got immediately was, "What were you wearing?" And this speaks very clearly to the fact that police officers still need training on how to approach sexual assault victims.
She says podcast host Sarah D'Elia is still with us here at McGlone Theater. Sarah spent a year talking to the woman we're calling Linda, the sexual assault survivor who has been brave enough to open her journey through the justice system to Sarah and through Sarah to you. But Sarah also spoke with countless people involved in the investigation of sexual assault crimes and in bringing perpetrators to justice. Everyone from nurses who perform the rape exam and create the rape kit to detectives and other law enforcement personnel to those who try and help survivors recover physically, emotionally, and mentally. We're going to spend the rest of this hour talking to some of them. Katrina Grau is Deputy Chief for the Investigative Services Group at CMPD, and Lieutenant John Summerendike is Special Victims Unit Commander with the Fayetteville Police Department. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
And thank you for driving up here from Fayetteville. Nice of you to do that. Mm-hmm. Crystal Emmerich is a two-time survivor of sexual assault and used those experiences to create an organization to help other women who have been through the ordeal. She is founder and executive director of Brave Step. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Deputy, when you hear comments like the ones we just heard from those women who volunteered their interactions with police, what goes through your mind? What do you think?
So for us as police officers, we want to help people. And so when I hear things like that, it's disturbing because being a victim of sexual assault is traumatic. And as police officers, we don't want our experience with the victim to be traumatic.
Had you heard those comments before, or was this the first time you became aware of
feelings? I've heard them from the podcast. I haven't
personally. But never before? Never before the podcast?
Certainly, there have been times before where victims have told us that officers haven't been as compassionate as we as an organization would want them to be.
Early in the podcast, Linda, who we spoke to, Sarah spoke to for a very long time, for the course of the year, made a point of saying that the police, her first encounter with the police officer, a female police officer, was the female police officer saying repeatedly, or asking repeatedly, "Now, are you telling the truth?" And admonishing her that if you're not telling the truth, you will be in serious trouble. And she later told Linda that she has to ask those questions and she has to make that statement. Is that true? And if so, why?
It is not our protocol to accuse victims of lying to us. I think certainly our responsibility is to thoroughly investigate a case. And what we all have learned over in our training and through our experience is that when a victim experiences trauma, they don't often remember things in a linear way that we may want as a police officer. You know, we like to hear, okay, this happened and this happened and this happened. And when you experience trauma, that's not how your brain files memories. And so we often have to ask victims to recount details in an event multiple times to help us capture all that information.
So what may appear to be badgering and or unkind is just a way to get at the truth the best way you can?
I think sometimes, I mean, we're looking for opportunities to corroborate what the victim told us, to present a case to the district attorney that they can convince a jury beyond a reasonable doubt that this happened. So when a victim tells us something, we're going to try to corroborate that. And it may be that the information that she gave us, we go out and try to verify and we don't find. And it's not necessarily that the victim intentionally lied to us, but may not remember what happened in a way that she communicated it to us. So there has to be opportunities for us to dialogue with that victim and maybe ask questions and understand that the information they give us the first time may change a little as we work through our investigation.
And Lieutenant Summerendike, you're with the Fayetteville Police, as I said, but you've been a Special Victims Unit Commander for nearly 4 years with extensive experience in this area. Is Linda's experience with CMPD, or the experiences we heard about from the women in that montage of audio we played at the top of the segment, is that, would those women be saying something similar about your department or about departments elsewhere in North Carolina?
Yeah, you know, I'd be really curious to know when they actually filed their rape reports. You know, I think I'm pretty confident in saying I've read almost every rape case file at the Fayetteville Police Department going back to the mid-80s. You know, up until the recent past, and I think I can probably speak for a lot of law enforcement nationwide, we didn't do that great a job with how we treated victims. We didn't understand the concepts of neurobiology of trauma, of toxic immobility. I didn't know what victim-centered meant until we got the Sexual Assault Kit Initiative grant just 3 years ago. I didn't understand that concept, and I think I probably speak for my entire agency. We didn't understand what victim-centered meant. But now,
would that be the case with every crime, or is that the case with rape, and would that be the case because police departments are by and large operated by males?
No, I don't think it's that. I don't know that's really a fair statement. Okay. I think with rapes in particular, it's a little unusual. It's just, I think, you know, I really do want to commend you guys. Your podcast really wasn't about bashing the police. I mean, that's pretty fashionable nowadays. Go ahead and bash the police for everything. It's our fault. Everything's our fault. So I do commend the direction you kind of took with this. I think really we need to be held accountable. I mean, I want to be held accountable for everything my detectives, my department does. I think all law enforcement does. But really with rapes in particular, I think culture in this entire country, among the community, among citizens, that's all of you out there too, all of you listening too, I think there's so much ingrained victim blaming, ingrained rape myths that we're only recently just overcoming. I mean, we haven't completely overcome anything. And all of you, you're our jury pool. Everyone sitting out here, everyone listening, you're all our jury pool. And that affects how we work cases to a certain extent. It affects how prosecutors go about prosecuting cases to a certain extent. So to answer your question, I think rape in particular, I think that's an unusual crime that we have come a long way, surely, in the last 3 years. My department has. I know Charlotte Mecklenburg has for several years. But as a country, I think we got a long way to go.
So, Crystal, you're a two-time survivor of sexual assault. You've established this organization called Brave Step to help other women go through this process. When you hear these women talk about their experience with law enforcement, this is an embarrassing situation to begin with. It's humiliating. It is toxic in every possible way. Is this part of the problem, the fact that police give off the vibe, perhaps, that they are not on the victim's side?
I don't think that it's only centered with the police or legal. From the experience that I've seen, just believing in general is so remiss in this country. I can tell you countless stories of parents not believing their kids, of the school systems not believing when sexual assaults are brought to the attention. I think that the problem is that we are so busy defending the perpetrators that we don't take the time to believe the victims. And I know that Linda specifically said at one point in her interview, believing me, and she stopped, but I can finish it. Believing me is everything. That's everything to healing. It's everything to the next step on your journey. And to not be believed is probably one of the worst parts of being a survivor.
And that's a theme that runs through the Me Too movement as well. Has the Me Too movement changed anything? Has it In cases of rape and in dealing with the survivors of rape, has it changed the way police view the victim and the way they handle the case? Or do you tend to believe them first and then investigate second?
I would say at the Charlotte Mecklenburg Police Department, that's our policy. Like I said, we're going to hear what the victim said, and then we're going to go out and try to find things to corroborate what she told us. I think the last thing we would ever want is a victim to come forward and say things about us as an individual or a police officer that we heard those victims say. And fortunately for me, I had an experience recently. I was an investigator in our rape unit from 1993 to 1997. And I had a victim come forward recently that I handled her case in 1995. And just told me that despite a very traumatic experience for her, that it's positive because of the interaction she had with us and with me individually. And so I think that's what we would all want. I think we would all agree on this panel that, as Sarah said, we don't want victims to be sexually assaulted. And short of stopping a perpetrator, there has to be other things we can do collectively as a police department, mm-hmm. as advocates, as media, to try to help victims not be victimized.
I want to hear from both of the police officers about this, because when I spoke with Sarah yesterday about this, I made a point of saying in the last segment that she saw a lot of problems and a lot of difficulty for Linda, at least, to get through the system. But she doesn't put the blame for those problems on any individuals. So where do you think the logjam lies? And I know that you, Lieutenant, have done a lot of work with expediting and fixing problems in how Fayetteville handles this, but where do you think the problems lie?
So, you know, DNA has evolved over time, and we as an organization look at best practices and try to evolve with those. So I'm not going to say anything that, as we've indicated, this case is still moving through the criminal justice system. And as much as I would like to maybe give specifics, I won't, because I don't want to jeopardize her ability.
Not the problems just with Linda, but just the problems in the system itself.
No, I want to say that in 2016, we were fortunate to get two grants that helped us purchase equipment in our crime lab that has significantly reduced the amount of time that a rape kit would stay in the lab. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, significantly. Right now, you indicated earlier that we had over 200 kits that needed to be tested. Currently, we have 121 kits.
Okay.
And the average amount of time for a kit to be tested in our lab is 39 days.
How many rapes per month in Charlotte, Mecklenburg?
We have we've averaged for the last 5 years about 280 a year, so 23 and a half a month.
So if we have 121 something rape kits left to be tested, that's half the year's worth. Why does it take so long?
We have, you know, other DNA involves other thing than just sexual assault. So we have, you know, homicide cases, robbery, burglary, larceny from auto that are tested in our lab. So we have 6 analysts. We have 3 analysts that are solely dedicated to sexual assault.
So it's a resources problem.
It is somewhat of a resource problem. You have equipment. There's time for that equipment to run the test. We can't do that any quicker.
Right. You had a completely different situation in Fayetteville when you came into your present job, Lieutenant. You had discovered that police officers were discarding rape kits. Why?
Yeah, so, you know, I started, first let me preface it. 121 rape kit backlog in the scheme of things, that's minuscule for a department that size. Go online, read the Attorney General's report on the statewide inventory. There's much smaller departments that have close to a 1,000 rape kit backlog. So Charlotte's done a phenomenal job with their backlog. We have a greater backlog than Charlotte. We're probably one-third their size.
So
they've done a phenomenal job with their backlog. They do need some credit with that. But anyway, going back to our problems. A few years ago, I started researching old sexual assault reports just to see if there was a need to form a cold case unit. I did find several reports right offhand, several case files I felt that were very solvable. The issues were we did not have the evidence on hand, so I found that we were disposing of evidence. Our chief at the time, Chief Medlock, ordered a complete audit of all of our sexual assault kits, so a hand count was done of every single one we had on hand, which at the time was 962, I think, thereabouts, that we had in our evidence room. And it was discovered, though, that over 300 had been destroyed over the years. And really, the bottom line was just to free up space in the evidence room is a very poor practice, you know, very, very bad practice. We probably could have put a lot more people in jail if we still had them, but that's what it revealed.
And these rape kits are critical, I would think, to helping solve the crime. Sarah, you also report that not all hospitals have access to rape kits, and not all victims get access to a rape kit. Right. How can that be?
Well, yeah, it's a really great question. We were inspired by our listeners. We had a few listeners that called in and said, we had a listener from Seattle who said that she was raped. And when she went after her assault, the hospital that had an emergency department did not have kits. And so she had to go to another hospital. But by then, several hours had passed. And ultimately, she says that the DA decided not to prosecute because there had been an issue with the amount of time that had passed and when she was actually able to get an exam. Mm-hmm. And then we had another listener from Tennessee who wrote and called us too. And she said that she knew she couldn't handle an almost hour-long drive to the nearest hospital that had an exam. So it's a resources issue for sure. And my colleague Alex Olgan took on calling 121 hospitals, licensed hospitals in the state of North Carolina to see where we are. We're pretty lucky, especially being in Charlotte. In a big city, you have more resources, yeah. But it's an issue in the rural communities in the state and around the country that don't have the access to SANE nurses, the sexual assault nurse examiners, let alone sexual assault kits or a nearby crime lab that they can get sent to.
And time is of the essence.
Absolutely.
You point out, Crystal, that not everybody chooses to go through a rape kit exam because it is your body is a crime scene, and it's treated like a crime scene. What would you tell women who face that ordeal? Would you say do it, no matter what?
It is so hard, Mike, because at the state, the mental state in which you're in, the mental and emotional, and setting the physical aside, because the physical really is the least of your worries at the end of the day, it is so hard to think clearly, and it's hard to know what your steps are. There's no manuals. You know, I'm raped. Here's the first thing I do. There's no existing guidelines. I haven't actually Googled that, but that's probably worth Googling. But nonetheless, I do believe even though it is another level of trauma to go through this, it is important to get the rape kit if they're available, because it does help us slowly but surely put these people behind bars. And I think that stops the cycle.
One of the other things that you say is that this system isn't really built for victims. I want to find out why you say that when we come back. That's Crystal Emmerich, founder and executive director of Brave Step. We're also here with a member of CMPD, the Fayetteville Police Department, and Sarah D'Elia, the host of She Says. It's a special edition of Charlotte Talks Beyond She Says, Sexual Assault in Charlotte, a public conversation from the McGlowan Theater at Spirit Square as a follow-up to the She Says podcast, a 10-episode podcast, the most extensive thing you've probably ever heard on sexual assault. And following each of those 10 episodes, host Sarah D'Elia, who's with me on the dais here today, invited people who had experienced sexual assault to anonymously share their experiences. One of the requests Sarah made to listeners was to describe their experience beyond the assault. She wanted to know if these women had filed a police report and the reasoning and emotions that surrounded that decision.
I was assaulted when I was active duty in the military. I did not file a police report because, as he said, no one's going to believe you anyway.
I didn't report anything because I was in denial for a long time. And even though I recognize now what he did was assault, I still have doubts that law enforcement and the justice system would have even believed me. I was sexually assaulted in my living room. I did not file a police report because, at the time at least, it was all very confusing, and I convinced myself that he thought he had consent, even though I was crying and saying no. And it took me a long time to come to terms with the idea that, you know, that had been a sexual assault.
I ended up filing a police report because actually the police officer encouraged me to do that. I wasn't going to, so she actually encouraged me to file a police report.
I did not file a police report because we had both been drinking that night. And even though I was the one blacking out and he was on top of me, I still felt responsible for what happened.
I did not file a police report. At the time, I was young and I wanted to pretend that it never happened because I felt so humiliated. I also didn't want my family to know because I felt like they would see me differently or blame me for what happened.
Crystal Emmerich is here from Brave Step, and you have said, Crystal, that the system isn't really built for victims and that it is so complex with so many layers that it can do damage to the individual. How so? And does that begin with the rape kit? Does it begin? Where does it begin? Where does that damage begin?
I think it's twofold. One, there's the damage that the perpetrator does and the mind games that come with being abused. In several of those recordings, you just heard the shame, the guilt, the sense of loss of control. But I also do believe that the system, the way our forefathers designed it, it was guilty until proven innocent. So it's on the survivor to advocate, as Linda and Emily did in all of the podcasts, so strongly to get good quality help. And that is of no, like, pointing fingers at no one at this stage. It's just the system isn't designed to make going through advocating and getting a conviction for perpetrators easy.
We do have this system in America where the perpetrator or the alleged perpetrator of a crime is innocent until proven guilty. And I think there are probably very few people in this room who would advocate changing that. But how do you make it easier, fairer, more navigable, particularly in cases like this, for the person upon whom the crime was allegedly perpetrated? How do you do it?
Mike, can I just, I think part of what we want to do here is help educate people, especially victims who may be reluctant to come forward. And one opportunity that exists that we haven't talked about is a victim can go to a hospital and have a sexual assault kit completed and do that anonymously. And law enforcement will collect that kit and store it, and we don't know who the victim is. And the victim may decide later that she's ready to come forward and report that to police, and then we still have that evidence. And so there is an opportunity for victims of sexual assault to have a sexual assault kit done and not report that to the police, but still allow us to collect evidence, or the sexual assault nurse examiner to collect evidence that we could use if down the road the victim decided that she was ready to come forward and talk to us about what happened.
Great information, but I don't think that answered the question. How do you make it fairer or more easily workable for victims of these crimes if we have to, and we do have to, presume that the person being accused is innocent until they go to court?
So I think what, you know, Lieutenant Summer and Dyke mentioned was, you know, victim-centered. And so it's our expectation as an organization of our police officers who respond to a victim who is reporting a sexual assault, or the detective who is responsible for following up, to do that in a way that shows empathy and compassion. And as I said, you know, it's we have to be thorough, but we have to be objective. And so, you know, to give victims an opportunity to catch their breath or cry or whatever that is, you have to show that compassion to victims and to allow them to be able to tell their story.
And it's not just police, it's the system itself, because you talked, Lieutenant, about victim blaming a few minutes ago. And in the podcast, we get little glimpses of Linda's case and from listeners who've shared similar experiences about them feeling like they have to prove that they are telling the truth and that they have to prove that they're not guilty of doing anything. And it wasn't because what they were wearing or the situation that they were in or that the place that they were in. They are always feeling they have to justify themselves as opposed to saying, somebody raped me, go after them. So, and you also say, Lieutenant, that when prosecutors put together juries, they're always thinking about the jurors not believing the victim. What's that all about? Why do jurors tend to not believe the victim?
Well, it goes back to what I said earlier. This is our jury pool out here. Society is our jury pool. And I honestly, wholeheartedly believe that there's still a large degree of victim blaming. There's a large degree of rape myths that exist that are ingrained in everybody. I mean, I consider myself the biggest advocate for survivors of rape in my department. I'll call somebody out in a heartbeat, but I catch myself reading reports and going, and then I have to say, whoa, hit the brakes. We'll back up a little bit. Just remember your training. Remember this rape victim. There may be reasons that she's not making sense in this report. I have to catch myself from engaging in victim blaming and buying into rape myths. So all it takes for a defense lawyer is to get one juror, one juror to buy into to his victim blaming, you know, his victim blaming rhetoric that he's spewing up there, and the case is gone. So that's the biggest challenge I think we face going forward in the justice system.
Does that happen in other kinds of cases, or is it just cases of rape?
I think more so in rape than anything else. I mean, I've investigated major crimes, homicides, robberies, kidnappings, ag assaults, and whatnot. But rape is definitely the hardest one by a long shot. When I hear juries saying they want character reference, they found him not guilty because they want a character reference for the victim. Why was the victim out there driving around at 2 a.m? Why was she walking around at 2 a.m? She has a marijuana arrest, 5 years before the rape happened. She must be a bad person. That means she's raped. When I hear idiot statements like that coming out of jurors' mouths as to why we're losing cases, then we got an issue. Society has an issue. It's not just law enforcement, it's society as a whole.
Mm-hmm. Sarah.
So there are a couple of points I wanted to make. One, when you asked that question about, is this a sexual assault investigation problem? Does this happen with other crimes? And something that comes to my mind is a special retired detective that we spoke to from Florida. His name is Terry Thomas. He's was an amazing resource for the podcast and really let us pick his brain. But one of the things that he said that really stayed with me was, you don't ask somebody, why'd you leave your garage door open if your car gets broken into? You take the report, but why is there so much questioning of the victim? And this was kind of his perspective, and that kind of goes back to the training that he really feels that needs to be instilled in detectives. Another thing that I think about is all the interesting conversations I've had with people about this podcast, and how I've talked to a lot of more men than women about this, of just how they had a really hard time connecting with Linda at first because they just kept thinking, why did you do this? Why did you do that? And so my question back to them was, well, why do you think that? And then it started this interesting dialogue and this interesting kind of like internal dialogue with themselves about their own judgments that they have.
Well, we should mention, for those who've not heard the podcast, that Linda's very open and honest with you at the beginning in the first couple of episodes about what led to the incident of the sexual assault. She had had a fight with her husband. She had taken a walk into an area that she knew she probably shouldn't have done because it was kind of sketchy. Somebody asks if they can help her. She mentions drugs. He takes her to somebody who can fulfill that request, and it is that individual who commits the assault, and she knows that she shouldn't be there, but she's there anyway. And that is that part of the problem? This is probably not an isolated incident. This probably has happened before, something similar to this. Does that make it more difficult for police to separate what got the person there from the actual physical act of, from the crime?
So I think it goes without saying that it shouldn't matter what any victim does. They don't deserve to be sexually assaulted.
Right.
So, but certainly it may create challenges for us in an investigation because, as Lieutenant Summerendike said, people are judgmental. And so our goal is to provide as much evidence as we can to corroborate what the victim told us, to present a good case for the prosecution, for the district attorney's office to move forward. So certainly it can create challenges in our investigation, but ones that we have to try to work through.
Linda's incident took place in 2015. I think it was June of 2015. You began talking to her in 2017. The last podcast in the series became available 2018, August of 2018. And evidently the progress of investigating this case was glacial, if that's a fair word to use, until the podcast began to air. And then suddenly the tempo began to pick up.
Well, I would say it was more when we, kind of, there were certain things that were the detective was doing. I want to be fair to that detective that they were doing and were working. But it was, there was a key moment where there was some evidence that they were going to collect and it looked like they were dragging their feet on it. And we did let CMPD know ahead of time that we had this sensitive audio, that we wanted to talk about it. We wanted it to always be an open conversation. And I said, I don't think it's black and white, but we need to have a conversation because you guys are part of it. And then after we let them know from the beginning that we had this tape, it was the next week that they did go and finally do something that they had been waiting to do.
Did the podcast pick up the pace, cause you to pick up the pace, or was it simply the progress of the case through any process that you'd have to go through, and it just happened to coincide with the podcast?
So again, I don't want to say anything that would compromise
Sure.
Linda's case, but I think even in the podcast, Sarah pointed out that there was efforts in the criminal justice system that are well documented in the criminal justice system where we were trying to get evidence to identify a perpetrator in early 2017 before we were even aware that a podcast existed.
Okay. And I want to point out that I'm speaking for Sarah here, that we were in touch with CMPD throughout this whole thing and playing tape and corroborating the story, and our intent was never to go get the police department. It was always just to investigate the story and the process and to illuminate the process. But you have listened to all of the episodes of this podcast, you and your colleagues at CMPD. What has resulted from you listening and learning from what this one woman went through?
So as I'm sure you all heard, I said, and I'll say it again tonight, I think there were things we could have done better. And I have spoken to the victim and told her that.
As a matter of fact, you met with her last night and apologized.
Right. I felt like that I was going to be on this panel, and that while I wasn't going to talk about her case specifically, I was going to talk about challenges that she felt like she experienced in her investigation. And it just felt insincere to me to do that without her knowing who I was and without me knowing who she was. And so I called and asked if I could meet with her, and it took us a little bit of time to coordinate our schedules, but I did spend about 2.5 hours with her last night. I think it's important for us as an organization to know how she felt and things that we can do to make all victims of sexual assault feel better. Some of the things that, as I said, one of the things that is a significant challenge was a significant challenge for us was the delay in a rape kit being tested. And due to the equipment that we have and some dedicating some additional resources to that, it is much quicker. I'm sure for a victim, it's still a very traumatic experience to wait for a police detective to call and say, okay, we have results in your case, but we have significantly reduced the amount of time that a victim is waiting for lab results. And as I said, most recently, we evaluated the amount of time that it takes from January of 2016 to present the kits that we have in the lab, and on average, it's 39 days.
And I think that is great, and I think that it is wonderful that CMPD did go and have a really candid conversation with Linda. I think it is worth pointing out, though, that her assault happened over 3 years ago, and it took quite a bit of time for CMPD to reach out to her and to have that difficult conversation that I know meant a lot to her. But it's been over 3 years, and there is a very public forum going on and a very public podcast that's, you know, shedding some light to this. So I appreciate the difficult spot that CMPD is in, but man, I feel like it has to be acknowledged that the timing of the meeting with Linda, I mean, it has been over 3 years since her assault, you know, and just to acknowledge that there were some things that Linda did herself and the work that she had to do as a survivor, I think that's something that a lot of people don't realize is just the amount of work, whether it's something like with Emily's case that we you know, the emotional work that Emily had to take on, or the actual investigative case Linda took.
We have 30 seconds left, Sarah, so let me turn it around and ask you. Your purpose was to follow this one woman through her journey and to make people understand what these victims go through.
Right.
When you find out how difficult it has been for her, and how long and arduous and frustrating and agonizing it has been, do you think that listening to this podcast may cause people who have experienced this not to want to go through the system?
I think Linda's story gives people hope. I mean, she put in the work and she got results. She is a fighter, and she is seeing the rewards of that fight. I don't think this will discourage anyone.
I want to thank Sarah D'Elia, Katrina Grau from CMPD, John Summerendike from Fayetteville PD, and Crystal Emmerich from Brave Step for being with us. A reminder, our podcast is available at NPR One and wherever you get podcasts. If you're a victim of sexual assault and are looking for help, we have several resources listed on our website at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.